if any of you noticed, but some of the materials that you worked with last time were missing this time.
Yes,
and some of you may have had feelings about that, and we'll talk. And those of you too, I will talk to you at break about that. But there was a reason we removed those things. If you noticed, like in your chair this morning, you found a particular candy, which was one of Heather's favorite dots. All you probably found was round things, right? Things that were round, because I'm going to be talking about trying to connect the dots. Does anybody resonate in their life with trying to connect the dots? I have long wanted to connect the dots in my life. And I have long believed that that's what I had to do. That if I could just fill in the space between those dots, life would work. The picture would be complete, like the thing we used to get, the sheets we used to get as kids, where the image would be revealed if you only could connect those dots. Rather, I found that the harder I tried to close the gap between those doggone dots, to pull things together in my life, to figure it all out, the quicker I found myself in a trap of disappointment, discontentment, and at times, even despair. And still, if Dr. Phil asked me, well, how's that working for you? I'd probably just blinked at him because I didn't know any different. As far as I knew, sometimes it seemed like it did work. Sometimes life intrudes. Sometimes we get sick of being sick. Sometimes life intrudes pretty dramatically. Like I was speaking to somebody at break, sometimes someone's having breakfast on a Sunday morning before they go to church to end up in the emergency department a little bit later. And their loved one of 40 years is in full arrest. Nobody woke up that morning thinking that's how life was going to unfold. They were just drinking coffee. And this was a 38-year-old. It's not a 70-year-old. This was a 38-year-old. So life intrudes. And usually, again, it's that reality that intrudes upon us that doesn't fit our paradigms. And it's the only way that we think we can make things work is by making the dots, connecting the dots. And you know, it's just like if those dots were, you know, not one-dimensional on the page, but actually were sitting on top of the page. And you've been trying, it's like somebody took the paper and went, boop! No connecting. I'm going to read you a little story from someone that was a mentor of mine named Harrison Owen. He used to be an Episcopal priest. He left the priesthood and is now an organizational, I guess, trainer or specialist, whatever you want to call it. And he says, in the early 60s, I was a graduate student at a university in the South. My field was Old Testament, and the limits of my world extended from the rather misty beginnings of the people of Israel around 1200 BC up to the turn of the millennium. On a daily basis, my life was measured out by class periods and endless hours in the library stacks. In addition, I'm married and fathered three children and was working on Sundays in rather conservative church. In terms of my own self-understanding, everything seemed to fit. All the dots connect. I saw myself as an academic, living in a world which appreciated academics. And while I can't say that I was totally unaware of the major changes that were occurring in the country at large in the early 60s, and particularly in the South, where I live, the whole business of desegregation and civil rights was by no means held a central place in my consciousness. My world was certainly not perfect, but I had no inclination to change it. One day, as I sat in the graduate student lounge watching TV, the program was interrupted by a special announcement. There had been a bombing in Birmingham. in a Birmingham church, to be specific, and three little girls had been killed. There seemed to be little question that the bombing was in retaliation for the civil rights activities that had been organized in that church. And although there were no suspects apprehended, it seemed clear who had done it. For reasons which I did not understand then, and still don't today, my world radically changed in a moment. It all looked the same. And in many ways, I was still doing what I'd always been doing before, but it was different and no longer very comfortable. I found myself in the midst of a series of public demonstrations protesting the bombing. Initially, I was only a participant trying to look as if I knew what I was doing and frightened to death. In my first demonstration, we had gathered in a vacant lot before moving out into the streets. And down the road, you could see the crowd and hear their angry shouts and curses. According to plan, we were to line up in pairs and march down the sidewalk, men and women on the outside and smaller folks next to the wall. I remember standing in the field looking for a partner when a small African-American girl, not over 7 or 8, came up and took my hand and said, "Can I walk with you, mister?" How could one so young be so self-possessed? Presumably, I was there to protect her. And yet, it was her strength that made it possible for the two of us, no, for me, to walk down that road. When it was all over, she released my hand and started to walk away, pausing only long enough to say, "Thank you, mister." In the days that followed, the obvious became inescapable. My world had changed, but I didn't know how much. My studies were in a shambles, but more to the point, I didn't care anymore, for they seemed irrelevant to what had happened. The pleasant Sundays that I spent working at the local church were terminated abruptly when it became quite clear that I was, or at least what I was becoming, was not who they were and wasn't welcome anymore. We mixed like oil and water. Most disturbing, however, were what was happening to my very family. There had always been some level of argument and malaise in my family, in my relationship with my wife in particular, but for all of that, we seemed to get along. The dots did connect fairly regularly, and I confess to having taken them pretty much for granted throughout the years, but suddenly there was silence between us, and eventually separation, and then downright fear and hostility. Had it only been my studies, or even my job, I suspect I would have made it. But when my family fell apart, my world was in pieces. What was worse, I really couldn't see any way to get back to the way it was. For my conscience had convicted me, and truth was, there wasn't any going back. He goes on to talk about that kind of death that occurred. Something outside of himself. Some might even say that didn't relate to him personally. But it did. And it changed his world and everything he knew. He couldn't go on as before. He couldn't connect the dots. He was out of control, he felt. But worse than that, he felt something had died. That there was a death. And the reason death matters, think about it, is because what has died matters. Whether it's people, or how we saw ourselves, or our career, or whatever, the reason death matters of anything is because what died mattered to us. And there's no two ways of getting around it. That we constantly have to let go. And it can come like it did for Harrison Owen out of left field and just be on the TV news. And everything changed. From that point on, his career changed. He ended up in Washington, D.C. He literally had a nervous breakdown. Everything changed in his life. Because, like we spoke of last night, the reality of things no longer fit his narrow view of God, of himself, of the church, even of his family. And what it felt in his spirit felt restricted. People thought he was crazy. Sound familiar? When he thought, well, I've got to be who I really am. I've got to follow this very unpainful death. I've got to continue forward in this meandering journey we have represented up here. And yet people thought he was nuts. Criticized, vilified, slandered. Yet he did choose to let go. And now he says he does with organizations, very similar, as a trainer would know, what he said I used to do as a priest. I marry groups together. I bury the dead. I say blessings and pray a lot. And his life has gone on and he's different. You know, I read a story about a segment on 2020 that did a study of 100 people who were 100 years old and active. Folks from all over the globe. And four attributes emerged when they talked to these 100 people that were 100 years old and active. How they managed to live to 100 years old and be active. And sane, and fairly happy. And this is what arose. One, they had a basic optimism about life and other people. Two, they had a passionate pursuit of some kind, some interest or cause, something that mattered. Three, some of us may like this one least of all, regular physical activity. And the fourth attribute, what do you think it was out of these 100-year-old people? They possessed the ability, yes, to, their words were, let go. We may have stumbled onto the fountain of youth. So perhaps one could actually connect the dots by letting them go, by learning to let them go. And perhaps like the trapeze artist, I don't know about you guys, but in the circus, I hate that act the most. More than the clowns, who I was always afraid of as a child. More than the magicians, which I thought were stupid. Because my anxiety level would be off the charts with those trapeze artists. If they had a net, I felt a little bit better. But every once in a while, you go to a circus, it's like, he will be working without a net. And I went, oh my God. Why do my parents make me go to this? I don't like it. But like the trapeze artists, our own life, we're trapeze artists. We just pretend like we're not. We're on the high swings, and most of us are working what? Without a net. And what we have to do, because I'm telling you, you're swinging back and forth. At some point in time, to get to the other swing, you have to let go. No. And you enter what spiritual directors would call the open space. It's not so much going to that other swing over there. It's that space. Where I'm not holding on to nothing. Where what mattered died. And I look in the mirror and I don't see anybody anymore. Not because I'm a vampire, but I don't see a reflection. Because who I used to be isn't there, and who I'm becoming isn't there yet either.
And that is the most painful area, is the open space. And yet, we can't go through that without letting go. And we can't get to the other side without letting go and being in the open space. That's the part about the death. That's the part of what dies matters, is that open space. It's the day after. That's what I think with the people that I deal with that lose a loved one in the ICU or the emergency department, is what happens the day after. They've done the letting go in the open space until they move on to the next part of their life. So letting go is involving death. It seems to be essential. And if you work in hospice like Heather does, and I did a practicum for there a season, you learn to see death as not an enemy, but as a transition, as a passageway. But it definitely involves a letting go and an empty space. And what you see people fear most, even people that have a relationship with God, you know, they'll tell you, I don't fear dying, you know, as far as being dead. I know I'll be with Jesus. They're okay. They really are. But they fear the dying process, the letting go, that letting go to this familiar reality of life. What happens? And yet, to live is to change. To change is to let go. To let go is to die. And just in that strange paradox that we could find only in Scripture, and to die is to live. Hell, there we go. So as much as death sometimes feels like a barrier, letting go, it is also the portal to what comes next. So letting go is not denial. Mm-mm. Not denial. It's not things falling off the wall. It's not condemning abuse. That's not letting go. Those of us that have experienced abuse in our lives, it's not condemning that. Or dysfunction in your families. That's not letting go. It's not behavior modification, ex-gay movement folks. That's not letting go either. Or for the highly spiritual, letting go is not being above it all. Letting go is, as I said, creating without controlling. It is defined as a portal to the open space. You know, when I was a kid, strangely enough, I would beg my father to get out into the water so that I could jump off the end of the deck, you know, and sort of kind of pretend swim to him. If I'd known that my father actually couldn't swim, I probably wouldn't have felt so safe about doing that, but he did not tell me that as a child. I trusted he would catch me and save us both. And as much as I wanted to do that, you know, get in that water and go to my daddy, that moment when I hurled myself, you know, I do a couple of start. Now this happened for real. Okay, a lot of that. It was like when I came to the point in my life when I was making these major transitions where I told somebody, I said, I felt like I was at the edge of a cliff with my toes curled over the edge. And God was saying, jump, like my daddy was, I'll catch you. Jump. What I realized is I couldn't turn back. Once you got to the edge of the cliff with your toes curled over, now you can stand there a heck of a lot of time, gals. You can be there decades if you want to, but it's pretty miserable. But by the time you've got to that point, you can't go back because everything has already changed behind you. There's no going back.
So when I go to the end of the deck, the pier to jump off, I notice two things happened at the same time. When I'm hurling through the air, I'm doing this. Oh my God, I'm going to die! At the same time, oh my God, I'm flying! That is letting go. And we sit in that paradox. We sit in that tension of I'm going to die! And I'm flying. That is letting go. It is a process. It is complex. Because we are complex, delicate, fragile little creatures who are mostly surprised by life. It is a courageous choice. And then sometimes it's not. As I said, life intrudes. It is continual. And it is a compassionate choice for ourselves.